The Hebrew word for a newspaper is iton. It was coined in modern times from a respectable biblical root, eight, which means season, time, period. The word eight has authority all of its own because it is the biblical word which is used most frequently in a very few verses, 27 times to be exact in eight verses in the book of Ecclesiastes, verses which I think you know. To everything there is a season and a time, eight, for everything that is under the sun. There is a time, eight, to be born. There is a time, eight, to die. There is a time to plant, and there is a time to pluck up that which is planted. These verses continue to suggest the seasonal differences, the differences in the elements of our life to which we must adjust. And they suggest that a foolish consistency is a dangerous thing, that if we live by a few snap judgments, a few pat philosophies, we lack the flexibility to adjust to the night and to the day, to the dark moments, and to the sun-filled occasions. Now, all this is by way of teaching you two Hebrew words, iton and eight, and also to suggest to you that when we deal with the power of the press, we cannot turn to the Bible or to the Talmud or to the Midrash, to any of our ancient literature, and find there, as we do so often, an appropriate paragraph, a cogent essay, a suggestive phrase, which will offer us insight and understanding. The first broadside to be printed regularly from a movable type press appeared in 1609 in Augsburg in Germany, the Avisa Relation oder Zeitung. 2,900 years before, Moses painfully chiseled a single copy of the commandments into the tablets of the law. Now, what I'm suggesting is this, that there was a time when men had laboriously and painfully to write out longhand or to cut into the clay or to chisel into the rock their histories, their news, their books. And there is a time today when the presses of the United States produce nearly 40 million newspapers every 24 hours. And that the impact of this intellectual and technological revolution can hardly be overestimated. In the first instance, it has destroyed distance. You and I know more about what is happening in London or Moscow or Paris or Peking than our grandfathers did about what was happening in a little village a few versts away. In the second instance, this flood of print, this flood of news, has destroyed our respect for the printed word. Our fathers received a letter, and they read it carefully, and they analyzed its every phrase, and they passed it around, and it was rarely destroyed. We skim, we speed read, we skip, we use yesterday's newspaper to kindle our fires or to wrap up our refuse. We read more, and I suspect we savor less. We read more and we remember less. We read more of that which is not worth the reading. If you receive the Sunday issue of the New York Times today, you will be receiving an anthology which includes more words than our entire Bible. And next week you will be receiving another Bible, and the next week another. And how much will you remember a week from now? Style, the sense of the beauty of language, the romance of words. All this has been bleached out of our lives as we try, most of us, to stay abreast of the news, to swim with this flood, this avalanche of information which cascades down on us. In the third instance, this flood of news has destroyed the hold of the past over us. Our ancestors had no news, And so they lived with their sacred books, and they understood the presence in terms of the insight and the wisdom and the hero figures of these books. Joseph was the prototype of every precocious and pampered lad. David was the prototype of every charming and charismatic leader. And Haman represented every oppressive reviler of Israel. The past was prologue. The past informed the present. That which has been is that which shall be. The present was familiar because we understood it as it had always been understood. There is nothing new under the sun. Men were familiar with their world. They expected little of their world. Change would come into the world, not through the efforts of men, but messianically, through the miracles of God. And there was also a universe of discourse possible between the generations and between neighbors. Every man studied the same books. Every man knew the same references. One could communicate easily. Today, the flood of the daily paper, the news, the magazines, the television draws our eyes from the past to the present, from our family out into the great big world. And we are exposed daily to 1,000 differing experiences. We live in the present. We think of the future. We are impatient with history, topicality, relevance. That's the cry. And we have lost this ability to communicate with one another, which our grandfathers had, with them, with our neighbors and with their children, because each of us is subjected in the course of a given week to a variety of stimuli, some self-selected, some because of the nature of our lives. We listen to different voices, we march to a different drum, and it becomes more and more difficult for us to understand the terms of another's point of view, to understand the experience which leads him or leads her to make the statements or to take the positions that they do. Distance has been destroyed. The sacredness of the printed word has disappeared. The past has ceased to be a bond and a shackle. We are a much more restless, future-oriented, possibility-oriented generation. And however much we might want to romanticize the past, we ought not, because ignorance never permitted men the capacity to deal with their problems. Only as we understand the swarming, teeming world can we begin to solve the great problems of life. So for blessing or for curse, we live in a new world which has possibility, and we must live in it. But how shall we handle the news? What can we do to make it truly meaningful? I think the first thing that we must do is to realize that there's a great deal of difference between information and understanding. And that is something that those who produce the news and those who consume the news, the editors and the readers, often forget. Most of what appears in our daily newspapers is not news. It's the facade of news. It's disembodied information. We read that the troops of Leopoldville and Brazzaville have skirmished in the upper reaches of the Congo River. 2 men have died. 3 men have been hurt. What does it mean? How can we use this information? It's floating in the air. We know who, where, when, but not why. We don't know if this was an accident or a serious skirmish. This was an incident or the beginning of a major war. We don't know how it will affect the two governments that are involved. We don't know if there are personality disputes among rival captains or rival generals. We don't know how the economic interests of the nations which are involved in these two African republics will be affected. We don't know what it means in terms of the ability of these two countries to survive economically or politically. We don't know really almost anything more than we do when we began. In fact, we're more confused than if this information had not been given to us. The cutting of a few paragraphs off the teletype of the Associated Press and of the United Press does not turn a shopping news into a newspaper. And most of the papers, the so-called newspapers in the United States, are really little more than advertisements for the local mortician and for the real estate people and for the shopping centers, with a few bulletins, a few headlines, a few photographs thrown in so that we will spend a few cents to buy advertisement. Now, that's not the way in which an informed electorate becomes informed. And if the editors of the United States mean what they prate about so often in public meetings, that the newspaper is the backbone of an educated electorate, it's the essential requirement of a democracy, that its function is to provide us the information on which we can, with which we can judge our public officials and public decisions, then I submit to you that the snippets of bulletins of dispatches and news which are presented to us, the pabulum which is presented to us most often by most newspapers, is only a sowing of confusion, and that if we think we are gaining understanding of our world, we are in fact losing our ability to understand what is going on. In fact, I have the belief that a great deal of the popularity of ideology, left, right, whatever it may be, especially among our young people, is due to the fact that they need a frame of reference in which they can neatly fit all the bits and scraps of information which pass before their eyes, and that all these ideologies which give you a neat, clear view of what the world is really like provide that need, and therefore they seem appealing and satisfying. Be that as it may, it's terribly dangerous for a nation to be fed 30-second clips of news as information, as if it were aiding our understanding, or two paragraphs of information, as though this was truly what we needed to know. During the 1950s, every week or so, our papers would tell us that the tanks of General Diem had rolled out of Saigon and had attacked a Montagnard village, or that there had been an assassination of a local tribal chief in one of the northern provinces, or that there was some troop movement through the plain of Jars. But how often in those years were men sent out to report day after day the interpretive material, the background information, which would have permitted Americans to be aware of what was involved in Southeast Asia and at least to ask the questions of a government which was stumbling more and more towards a major military commitment. How much do we hear today, really, about Thailand, or Laos, or Cambodia? We'll get a brief notice. There's been a grenade attack on an airbase in Thailand. Suvarnabhumi has made a speech. There's been some troop movement in the Plain of Jars. But what does it mean? Do you understand it? I don't. Can we understand it from our newspapers? I submit to you that we rarely can, because rarely do the newspapers involve themselves in sending out men who know the background of a country, who can speak its language, and who can get the information which we truly require. When the vice president attacked the Washington Post and the New York Times, he accused them of using their news columns for opinion. In the New York Times, Mr. Sulzberger, in his rather ponderous but beautifully punctuated response, answered that, as a matter of fact, the New York Times was very careful to report the news as news and to leave opinion aside for the editorial page. Now, thank God that papers like the New York Times do not live up to their own pieties. Throughout any edition of the New York Times, there are a dozen signed articles by competent reporters telling us what is happening someplace in the world, something more than the official communique from Beirut, which has no meaning. It's designed to be public relations, to be propaganda, who give you background in the field, and permit you to understand at least something of the news. I wish the editors of our newspapers would get over the feeling that by claiming that they are so pure that editorial opinion, that personal opinion is limited to the editorial page, that all they can print on the rest of the paper is that which has no meaning. The official white papers, the official communique from the White House, from some other government. And that they would honestly go about in the rest of their newspapers presenting us background, depth, and real insight and understanding, and give us credit for being able to understand that every man necessarily writes his own opinion, that nothing is the revealed law by God to Moses on Mount Sinai. But at least there's some place to start. You can't start with a communique about a river skirmish on the Congo. The New York Times also has in its masthead the motto, "All the news that's fit to print." Now, it's a great motto, and the New York Times seriously tries to live up to it. And the degree to which it lives up to it is a standing reproach to most other newspapers. But Mrs. Silver and I were in Guatemala 2 years ago about this time, and we happened to be in Guatemala at the time when some of the rebels came down from the hills and there were a series of assassinations, including the assassination of the senior American military advisor. Martial law was proclaimed. There was serious talk of asking for a commitment of American troops to protect American interests. And lo and behold, we discovered that for that week, and at least the week previously, and for many weeks before that, there had not been a single accredited United States newspaper reporter or television commentator in the whole country. And whatever news we were getting out of Guatemala came from the official Guatemalan government, or came from the newspapers of Guatemala, each with their own axe to grind, each with their own point of view. And here we were in a situation where American intervention might very well have resulted. And how much information had the American people received? How could they judge? We were utterly dependent upon the goodwill and the good intentions of our own government. Well and good, but we must also have an opinion of our own as an electorate, as a citizenry. And there was simply no reason, no means for the American people to have gotten this kind of background. There was no one there to report it. News. News is depth. News is understanding. News must have meaning. It cannot simply be the surface. You can't report complex international events the way you might report an automobile accident. Such and such a car hit such and such a car at such and such an intersection at such and such a time with such and such damage. And I gave you the example last week when we were talking about Israel, of how the terrorist activities have made headline after headline in the United States. We think, many Americans think, that Israel is beleaguered and besieged in a way which is beyond comprehension. And yet I remember I suggested to you that there are 2.5 million people in Greater Cleveland, and that there are 2.5 million people in Israel, and there have been more men, women, and children die violently in Cleveland in the last 12 months than have died in Israel violently in the last 12 months. And you couldn't possibly understand that kind of equity, that kind of balance, if you simply read day after day the black headlines, supermarket bombed, child killed in this or that community. And what is true of the newspapers is true in spades, I'm afraid, of the television. The television has discovered a wonderful media for the communication of bulletins and of headlines, the 7 o'clock news, the 11 o'clock news. News is convenient. It can be cut up into short stretches and short pieces. You can get a lot of commercials, a lot of income from it. But how much do we really know once we've finished with these news programs? And how much real news, depth, coverage, do the television networks give us? They're required by law to have a public interest. And they do cover quite well those extravaganzas which are produced for them. The national conventions, a political campaign, the funeral of an ex-president, President Nixon's speech. These they cover fully and well. But how often do we see in prime time a serious attempt to understand the oil leases which have been given out so easily in Alaska, or the plight of the poor in Appalachia? Oh, there'll be an occasional program, an occasional fit of conscience, but rarely so, unfortunately. And usually public interest programming in the local stations is limited to Sunday morning at 8:30. Where three local clerics are invited without recompense to them to discuss with a commentator who is being trained for covering the evening news, an amateur about to become a professional, to discuss without preparation or background one of the issues or another which is of interest in the day. That's not news. Very often it's interesting. Very often it's no more than an exchange of ignorance. Coverage is research, digging. The local television stations lack the personnel. They haven't made the financial commitment to really dig out the stories from Cleveland. And all too often, the great national TV network stations are concerned with the official news, the official release, rather than sending their men out to do the kind of coverage which would be helpful to all of us. What I'm suggesting to you is simply this, that news coverage in the United States is good, it leaves much to be desired, that it is too interested in the bulletin, it's hung up by the hangovers of the tabloid age and yellow journalism when all the emphasis was on speed, on the scoop. It mistrusts us. It believes we'll read only a line or two and no more. Therefore, it does not spend the time or involve the men to really produce research and meaning for us. And these are real issues, and they can be debated and discussed at length. But when the Vice President of the United States chose mid-November to take on the dragons of the television industry and of the great publishers, the American press, he did not choose to discuss these issues. Rather, he gave a rather petulant and querulous attack on the way in which the television media in the first instance and the Eastern newspapers in the second instance had been covering the new United States administration policy for peace with honor in Vietnam and the Vietnamization of the war. He complained bitterly, you'll recall, in Des Moines, against the instant analysis and querulous criticism which had followed the November 3rd speech of the president. He asked, when Winston Churchill rallied public opinion to stay the course against Hitler's Germany, he didn't have to contend with a gaggle of commentators raising doubts about whether he was reading public opinion aright or whether Britain had the stamina to see the war through. There had come the time in our nation's history when the administration had decided to pull out all the stops to sell, and it's properly so, its policy for Vietnam to the nation. Its policy is mutual withdrawal, direct negotiations, some kind of pre-election in Southeast Asia, and failing all of these if the Viet Cong and the North Vietnam prove unwilling, the turning over of the actual fighting in Vietnam to the armies of the South Vietnamese government. And the administration has been disturbed by the peace demonstrations, by the moratoriums, by the growing sentiment in America for a quick end to the war, to cut our losses and to get out. And they used them this last month for a massive public relations campaign. The president's speech was much heralded. The speech was given. The day after the speech, there appeared what was obviously a carefully coordinated public relations campaign in the press. Those big full-page ads signed by concerned citizens for peace with honor in Vietnam, with the insert asking you to clip this out and send it in support of the president. A resolution was quickly introduced into the House of Representatives, which was ultimately signed by 300 congressmen supporting the president's initiatives from Jerusalem, from the Vatican, from elsewhere. Sympathetic people were induced to speak out in behalf of the president's good intentions. The vice president and others were sent throughout the length and the breadth of the land to attack those who dissented and to bring their positions into question. The president has now gone so far as to attempt to use Moonglow to sell his product. He has just appointed as an assistant secretary of state for public affairs, the first astronaut to walk on the moon, a task which qualifies him magnificently to interpret the war in Vietnam to the youth of the United States. And all of this was carefully coordinated and carefully planned and quite proper. But what was not proper was the attack which ensued against the force in the United States which said this is a public relations campaign. It is administration policy to be sure, but this is a free country and we have a right to discuss it. And who else can do this in the United States but the public press? And who else did it but the press and the television? And the result was that Mr. Agnew invited himself out to the hinterland, first to Des Moines, and then to Montgomery in Alabama, and there delivered of himself of attacks against those who were misleading and misguiding the nation, who would have us achieve peace without honor, who were intemperate in their criticism, the kooks and the kids, and the Eastern liberal establishment. And he went further in this rather narrow partisan attack. He talked about the monopolization of power in the hands of an elite few, self-perpetuating few, unelected few, whose views, he went on to say, are unrepresentative. The views of the majority of this fraternity do not, and I repeat, do not represent the views of America, with a clear implication that they have, they're somehow manipulating American public opinion in ways which are not to the benefit of our nation. He reminded many of some, though with a little bit more caution, of some of the speeches which Governor Wallace had made a year ago during the campaign, one of which I would quote to you. Anyhow, Wallace said, there are more of us than there are of them. And we're going to show them in November that the average American is sick and tired of all those overeducated, ivory-towered folks with pointed heads looking down their noses at us, and the left-wing liberal press writing editorials and guidelines. Now, many who read the two speeches or heard the two speeches of the vice president, which, by the way, were fully televised and fully printed by the Free Press of the United States, many of those who read these two speeches said to me, you know, he said some of the right things, perhaps for the wrong reasons, or, well, you've got to give him credit for courage, or it's about time that somebody said some of these things. Perhaps. I'm not sure. The public press must always be under public scrutiny and careful scrutiny, as I've suggested to you. But there is a degree of intimidation implicit in the vice president's approach. He did not, as a philosopher, consider the role of the press in the United States. He went down to Montgomery, Alabama, where there are two newspapers, both owned by the same conservative publishing house, and two television, local television stations, which have interlocking directors with this newspaper. And he berated the Washington Post for being the only newspaper in the capital city of the United States. Not a word about the two Montgomery papers owned by a single family. Not a word about the inability of the local black community in Montgomery to find free expression of their views in their local paper. Not a word about the inability of some of the youth of Alabama to find their full expression of their radical points of view in the Montgomery newspapers, but only a petulant complaint that in Washington and in New York, because of the Washington Post and because of the New York Times, his views and the views of his audience, his carefully selected audience, there was not an affirmation, a celebration of certain points of view as those which this nation must affirm. Now, we must have a free press, and the press, through its columnists, must present to us a variety of points of view, obviously. But I wonder about this constant complaint about control, about monopoly. How can any news media begin to dig, to give us the coverage, unless they have the budget, the money with which to do it? We have two newspapers here in the city of Cleveland. They can, on the basis of their income, provide rather adequate coverage of the events of the city of Cleveland. They can't possibly begin to send reporters to every capital in the world. They can't begin to put 15 or 20 men into Washington to dig out story after story after story. Only a few national newspapers can. And we must depend upon those great national newspapers, the Times and the Washington Post and the Los Angeles Times and others, to dig out the information which we as a citizenry need. And what's true of the newspapers is true of the television. Our local television stations could not begin to give us the news of the world or the news of our nation's capital. We need great news syndicates. They need to be free. They need to be self-policed. They need to be criticized often. But they need to be free. And they need to be big. Big government needs the counterpoise of big news agencies. We may not like it. Both are guilty, are easily prone to abuse, but that's the way it's got to be, I'm afraid. And if the government is complaining about the control of three of the television networks of news coverage, they have only really themselves to blame. Because our government in the last years has been very careful in limiting the number of licenses for local television stations which have been approved. The result, there are more channels on your television set than there are stations providing pictures through those channels. There could be other networks. And more than that, can the network create news when there is no news? And I mean now not only the dramatic confrontation, not only the violence, but news itself. The great silent majority is great, and it is silent because it's doing nothing. Because it's busy earning a living, because it's busy pocketing a few dollars, because it's busy watching sports on television, because it's busy reading the facade of news, which is not news, in the local press. It is the few who make news. It's the few who make revolutions. It's the few who make decisions. And ultimately, it's these few, these decisions, and these actions which must be covered. Yes, there have been abuses, some terrible ones. There have been pictures which have been deliberately staged. There is the danger that the ever-present television camera precipitates demonstration when demonstration might not otherwise exist. And yes, there is an intrusion of privacy on the part of the television and personal tragedy, which I find personally contemptible. But what can we do? We must live with the possibility, with the reality. And the reality is that the great silent majority, if there is such, does not make news, that it will not determine how America will change, and that the battle for their minds must include the input of information and of contrary opinion to those who would lead them sheepishly. Agnew, where they would go. Now, the news media are not saintly, and they are not without their prejudice, but they're not without their ultimate necessity to our nation. The second charge with Mr. Agnew leveled against the media, which many thought to be well taken, was the idea which he phrased in this way, that good news drives out bad news, that normalcy is the nemesis of the evening news. Somebody loves the end. Normalcy is the nemesis of the evening news. That a minute of Stokely Carmichael is worth 10 minutes of Roy Wilkins. Now, all of us are disturbed that the media go for the dramatic, go for the violent, and that they do not offer us a picture of America as we think it really is. That's not so much the fault of the news as what we consider and the television considers the news to be. 30 seconds. How much can you see? You focus on a placard, one sentence from a speech, and that's news. Well, it's about time we turned off that kind of news, because it isn't news. News is an essay. News is a full approach to a particular problem. News is turning to the national magazines, which give us background. to the news of the week in review, to the columns, to the nonfiction works. News is, the gathering news is in part our own responsibility. And news is the recognition on our parts and on the parts of those who dispense it that everything must somehow make sense, must have roots, must have a perspective. We alone can really provide that perspective, though we need great help from the media. I hope that one result of these two speeches by the Vice President will be not that the media people cloak themselves in saintly armor and say, look, we're the last bulwark of American freedom, but that they take a good look at themselves. Not because the Agnews of the country complain that their points of view are not receiving the shrift that they deserve. They are receiving full coverage. But because the media are not living up to their full capability in providing you and providing me with the kinds of information, with the kind of understanding which a free citizenry absolutely requires. There's a time for a politician to speak out in behalf of a Southern strategy. And there's a time for a national leader to speak to the interests of the nation. When you deal with the news, with information, with the free flow of ideas, no one, I submit, does the nation a service if he speaks out without concern for the larger issues. He speaks only in a narrow and partisan way. That's what I'm afraid has happened. I'm disturbed particularly that many in the administration seem to have applauded these two speeches. I'm afraid that in response to them, the media may simply continue to do what they have always done to prove that they are not being cowed or in any way intimidated. What they've done is not enough for any of us or for the future of our nation. Amen.